This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of January 8th, here are a few top stories. In the news, the state attorney general is challenging the Arizona Board of Regents. Here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich is defending his right to challenge state university tuition increases in court this week. Last year, Brnovich filed suit against the Arizona Board of Regents for raising tuition at the three state universities to an unconstitutional level over the past 15 years. But attorneys for the Regents asked the court to throw out the case. Their argument, that the Attorney General can only sue when he has specific legislative authority or permission of the governor, and they say he has neither. Here to tell us why he thinks he does have the authority to bring the case is Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Mark, good morning.
Thank you, Steve, for having me on. Thanks. Good to hear you guys, Mark. Thank you very much.
So let's not go too far in the legalese, but what is your argument to say you do have the right to push this?
Look, what is essentially happening is the university is spending public dollars. They're a state university, and someone has to have the ability to serve as a oversight or in a check roll on them when they violate their legal responsibilities and duties. And so our argument is essentially twofold. One is they are violating state law, that is Proposition 300, by illegally subsidizing people that do not have legal status here in the United States with their tuition. And secondly, they're violating the Arizona Constitution, which specifically requires that education be as nearly as free as possible. They're violating that by skyrocketing tuition costs over the last 15 years.
So, Mark, are you putting a lot of that weight on the fact that DACA students are getting in-state tuition? And if they were not, that would somehow relieve some of the burden from people who are actually born here in Arizona?
Well, look, the bottom line, Steve, is that when you think about it in the university's arguments, they're saying essentially that they have to give in-state tuition to the DACA students in order to make it affordable for them. But the reality is, if tuition hadn't skyrocketed over the last 15 years, 9 to 10 times faster than the rate of inflation, 12 to 13 times greater than the increase in median family income, they wouldn't be having to offer any of these kind of subsidies. And so that's the problem. The problem is that no one for the last 15 years in the state has said, well, wait a minute, why does university tuition keep skyrocketing? Why is it going through the roof? Why has it become unaffordable for middle-class families, for taxpayers here in Arizona? For people like me, when I went to ASU in the late 1980s, it was about $625 a semester. I could work a part-time job, work in the summer, and you know what, Stephen, Mark, how much debt I had when I graduated from ASU? Zero. And that's what everyone should have, the same access to a quality education that's nearly as free as possible. And 15 years ago, the university set tuition based on being in the bottom third of what other state universities are charging. Now we've gone from there to being in the top third. There's something fundamentally wrong about that.
Mark, in your mind, what role does the legislature play in this? Because I think there would be some people who would argue, especially those with the university, that one of the reasons, anyway, that tuition has had to go up is because state lawmakers and governors have cut so much money from universities that they have to make it up somehow.
Well, you know, Mark Twain once famously said that there's, you know, three kind of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And one of these statistics, when you look at the fundamental or the numbers of financing, university tuition over the last 15 years has risen about 15 times the last decade, 15 times, or excuse me, four times greater than the cuts. So has the legislature cut money from our state universities? Yes. But the question is, why has tuition gone up four times faster than those cuts? And has it gone up it's so fast, so quickly, that it's no longer constitutional what the regents are doing? And one of the things I do want to emphasize is, you know, the regents changed the formula. In the old days, the regents had a formula that was based on keeping our state universities in the bottom third of what other state universities are charging. They've changed that formula. Now it's a formula based on what other public universities are charging and based on the availability of financial aid. And so my question is, well, just because some kid or maybe some working person that's going to school part-time can get student loans or get jacked up with $50,000 in debt, that doesn't make the university affordable or nearly as free as possible. What it does is it allows the universities to keep charging more and more for tuition, and they've stifled, quite frankly, any sort of competition from the community colleges or even Grand Canyon University.
Who do you think at the end of the day should have final say over tuition rates? Because there are, of course, proposals in the legislature to make the legislature in charge of that kind of thing.
Well, Look, this the analogy I would use is the reason why we have a corporation commission, because the corporation commission was set up to act as that check to protect consumers and be that block against public utilities that may take advantage of consumers. Likewise, the regents should be there to serve the students, to serve the Arizona taxpayers, to make sure that tuition is nearly as free as possible. And I think that's one of the problems. What we've seen from the regents, at least, is that they've acquiesced and allowed the universities carte blanche. And so that's why, Mark and Steve, you end up in a situation where the Board of Regents do not have a constitutional mandate to turn mediocre athletic coaches into millionaires for life. But they do. They do have a constitutional mandate to make sure tuition is nearly as free as possible. And so this, to me, is about priorities. And I think both of you heard me say, I'm not a policymaker. I do think, though, that I believe very strongly in the rule of law. I believe in the Constitution. And if people don't like that provision in the Constitution, if they think it's some sort of Bernie Sanders-esque, a Don Quixote fight we're on, then they should change the Constitution. But by my goodness, I think people have an obligation to follow the law. They have an obligation to follow the Constitution. And I do think, and at my fundamental core, that a four-year college degree is one of the most fundamental licensures of modern society. And I know as a middle-class kid growing up here in Arizona, that if ASU had been the tuition it is now, I might have never been able to graduate. And I think that's a tragedy, because I think every middle-class family in Arizona, I know every middle-class parent dreams, I think, of two things. One, being able to own their own house, and two, being able to afford their send their kids to college. And I think that's slipping away, and somebody's got to do something about it.
Mark, briefly, one thing, I guess we're not going to call you Berno Sanders now. I just wanted to make sure we know that, since you're not going to. The last thing, really briefly, and this is a big philosophical question, so it's hard to make it brief, but we need it to be brief. As nearly free as possible, that phrase has been used over and over again. Does anyone really know what that means now?
Well, this is the thing. This is one of the things the universities are relying on. There was a case that dealt with this question where the universities have increased tuition, last decade. And I'm not saying there's a magic number, but I think that we have a right to know what the actual costs are. And we have to do everything, or the regents need to do everything they can to keep that cost as nearly as free as possible. I recognize that there's capital cost, and there's costs of hiring professors, and there's a cost associated with education. The question is when you're, if the universities are into real estate developments or paying off coaches $18 million in contract, then why are they charging athletic fees? Either they have the money or they don't have the money to do what they need to do.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, guys.
From KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's Mark Brody.
In the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, there's a scene in which Indy, played of course by Harrison Ford, and his dad, played by Sean Connery, are in a castle in Nazi Germany, tied to the same chair, trying to get loose. They scoot into a fireplace to get away from a fire which is consuming the room they're in.
I think I can get these ropes up.
While trying to unbind his hands, Indiana Jones accidentally leans into a metal bar, which swivels the pair into a hidden room where Nazi military personnel are working. And while many of us may think hidden rooms and passageways are only for Hollywood, or castles, that is not necessarily the case. Steve Humble is the president and founder of Creative Home Engineering, a Gilbert-based company that specializes in making secret passageway doors for luxury homes. And Steve, what are people using these for? I mean, I think of that scene from Indiana Jones. That can't be what you're doing, right?
Actually, it is sometimes. And that movie was an inspiration for real secret passageways that we have built, along with many other Hollywood movies. So a lot of clients have seen a movie that they like, and whether it's for security or just for fun, they've decided, I want something like I've seen in that movie in my house.
Why are people wanting these?
Well, that's a good question. I don't always ask, because we respect our clients' privacy, and obviously the nature of what we do is very private. I can't tell you, some of them do volunteer that information. And over the years, it has shifted. We've been doing this for, 17 years or something, and it has become more and more for security. In the early days, there was a lot that were just for fun. And now we're finding that more of our clientele has a legitimate security purpose.
So are you finding that people want these as a place to put their stuff as opposed to like a safe room for people to go into?
Everybody wants it to do double duty. I think from a practicality standpoint, people start out saying, okay, well, you know, I've got these valuables, I want to protect them, but then as long as I've got the square footage on my house, I might as well make it so that I can go in there if somebody breaks in.
Do these tend to be custom? I mean, are there home builders that you work with that will put something like this into a home, hoping that it will serve as an amenity that a buyer will want?
Yeah. So historically, they were all custom. And that's not to say that they were never used in spec homes. Usually, well, it's very common for builders to be building a spec home and look for something that's really going to set their house apart from the other homes that they're competing against. And we found that nothing can really set a house apart as much as having a really cool and memorable secret passageway in it. It suddenly becomes the house with the secret passageway in it, you know? So they have been historically custom. However, we've started to release a new line of secret doors. We have released a new line of secret doors that are designed for more middle-class kind of people. And it's a very standardized product, and that's how we get the price down. And we're selling, those are selling like hotcakes to builders and homeowners alike all over the world.
I have to ask, though, if one of these products is in a spec home, for example, and people coming to an open house know about it, does that in some way defeat the purpose of having it?
Yeah, well, it would, and that question has been put to me before. I think some people sort of get around it by saying in the listing that there is a secret passageway, and if you want to see it, you got to buy the house, or you know, once you put down a deposit, we'll show you where that is, or something like that.
How much have your sales increased? I mean, how much more demand is there for these products now than there has been in the past?
Demand has steadily been growing. Everybody always wants to say that, you know, maybe it's because of the state of the world today, and maybe that is part of it. I really don't speculate to why the reasons are.
Well, do you find that your sales go up during times of crime waves or other, you know, situations and incidents where people maybe feel a little bit less secure in their own lives and maybe even in their own homes?
I think that there is a correlation, but it's not quite as simple as saying, you know, there's a crime wave and then sales go up, because particularly in the custom sphere of products, it takes a long time for these houses to get built. And so the idea doesn't go from the client's head to our bottom line overnight. It oftentimes will take months for these things to develop. And so it's difficult for me to pinpoint a sales surge to a particular world event.
Steve Humble is the president and founder of Creative Home Engineering, a Gilbert-based company that specializes in making secret passageway doors for luxury homes.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In business news, a school-centric model once turned the tide against poverty, violence, and drugs in South Phoenix, but now the area is seen as a dumping ground for projects that wouldn't fly in other parts of the city. KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports why some say the neighborhoods around the Murphy Elementary School District are slowly dissolving.
Traffic blows past Karina Mejia as she waits to cross Buckeye Road in South Phoenix. City officials just pushed a homeless encampment out of an area near downtown, but here, on the edge of 33rd Avenue, the displaced have built a tiny village.
And this one, it just keeps growing and growing and growing because it wasn't that big a couple of weeks ago.
Slightly north and about 10 blocks east, the former superintendent of the Murphy Elementary School District visits a park on a January morning.
When I came back here just about a year ago, and saw this, I was brought to tears.
It was on Bob Donofrio's watch when parents, nonprofits, and local business owners slowly took back their neighborhoods. They made Murphy the center of everything. But the approach changed sometime after Donofrio left in 2004.
And I think the district has lost its connection with the community.
Murphy's enrollment has dropped by more than one-third in recent years. Now there are about 1,500 students left at four schools. The state initially graded them a C, two Ds, and an F. Donofrio sees the district's decline as a key factor in a handful of problems causing the area to slowly disintegrate.
You know, I love this community, and it's always been in my blood, but I think the school district will financially collapse.
Murphy is Arizona's poorest school district that's not on a reservation, says current superintendent Jose Diaz.
So we are barely surviving.
The neighborhoods around Murphy are falling apart, Diaz says, and he wants to get back to the school-centric model. Right now, he's focused on student safety and what's happening in the classroom.
When we compare a year ago to this year in reading, we went up at least 1 point. So we are in the right direction.
Murphy's students live near jails, a juvenile detention center, a private prison, and a homeless shelter. Diaz says the shelter and Governor Doug Ducey's failed plan for two more state prison facilities brought everyone to the table.
A giant that was sleeping woke up in this community. And we are together. And we are going to continue. And we are not going to allow nobody to come and destroy us anymore.
An odd mix of residential and industrial land surrounds the Murphy School District. Precision Components has been here for more than 50 years, and unloading railroad cars is one of its key services. Kimberly Owens works for the company, and Diaz credits her with bringing everyone together.
I feel like this area of Phoenix gets the dump all the time.
Owens disagrees that the area is falling apart, but it still needs many things.
We don't have a public library in this neighborhood. We don't have a Boys and Girls Club. We don't have a YMCA.
One of the people Owens helped get involved is Dan Mardian, owner of neighboring Marco Crane and Rigging.
It kind of gave me a wake-up call about the needs of this community.
With the state having nixed the plan to add more correctional facilities, Mardian says the next step is to find out how to help Murphy.
I feel obligated to give it a shot.
Mardian wants the area around Murphy to have a renaissance, and that would be great for Karina Mejia. She says it's not even safe for kids to play at another neighborhood park. As Mejia walks from the parking lot toward the deserted playground, she passes a man leaning against his car and smoking marijuana. Mejia says she'll never leave this neighborhood. Her family has been here since the 1960s.
These are my roots.
And if she has to, Mejia says she'll fight alone to make this place better for her own children. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, universities across the Southwest are stepping up the work they do with counterparts in Mexico. They're looking for ways to send more exchange students and to do more scientific research together. As Jorge Valencia reports from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, the story of one biology student from Northern Arizona University explains how.
Laura Lillis is a college student who grew up studying Spanish. After high school, she even spent a year in South America. But before she got to her year abroad in Mexico, she had never taken a science class in Spanish.
And I'm giving a presentation on the second week of school for, they said, about 20 minutes. About 20 minutes.
And that wasn't her only class.
Environmental analysis, urban ecology, and animal ecophysiology.
All of them in Spanish. All in a small suburb outside a small city in the middle of Mexico.
Because of the way the school works and I'm the only foreign exchange student, nobody speaks to me in English, so.
Lillis took the challenge with enthusiasm, and she'll tell us how she did in just a moment. But first, let's look at where she fits in within this industry of international higher education. Mexico has long been a natural destination, says Daniel Palm, who's in charge of global initiatives at Lillis's home of Northern Arizona University.
But I think the primary reason of Mexico is it's a border country to the United States. And so it's so key that we interact with Mexico, that we have great partnerships with Mexico, and that there's an understanding between our two nations.
In the last few months, Northern Arizona University, Arizona State, and the University of Texas have rolled out plans to exchange more students or to collaborate on scientific research with schools in Mexico. This is something the University of New Mexico and the University of Arizona have also been doing for a while. And in many cases, it allows schools in the U.S. to get dollar-for-dollar matching funding for research from Mexico. Rafael Rangel is the former president of the elite Tecnológico de Monterrey University. He often takes Americans down south in his new role as a special advisor at ASU.
They think they are going to go to an old town, and when they go and see all the power of companies in development and things like that, they change their perspective.
Rangel says a lot of what he and administrators at other schools are doing is to show Americans that they shouldn't be afraid of Mexico and to show Mexicans that they shouldn't be suspicious of the U.S.
The universities have to become the engines of the development.
A lot of this renewed energy is possible because the State Department began issuing security warnings on a state-by-state basis instead of a blanket warning for the entire country, says Susan Popko, a board member on the Forum for Education Abroad. She sees another trend dovetailing with this one.
Diversification outside of Europe. So historically, Europe was where the majority of U.S. students went. Now we're under 50%. And what that has meant is that students are going to lots of different regions.
Europe, or more specifically Spain, was the other country that Laura Lillis had initially considered for her study abroad. Lillis is the biology student from Northern Arizona. And she's the first student on an official year-long NEU exchange program since the university suspended activities for security concerns. She says she's happy she chose Mexico. Her first semester went so well that by the end of it, it was easier for her to explain science in Spanish than in English. For example, her final project for that class where she had to give that presentation.
You could see like the difference in noise pollution, and you could see the difference in just the fraccionamientos, like neighborhoods.
And she didn't do too bad.
I got a 9.5 in the class, so that's an A. So I think they went pretty well.
Lillis says that coming from a state like Arizona, any Spanish is useful, including technical Spanish that she will use in her lab work. And this upcoming semester, she'll create her own study plan, doing research alongside a professor at her host university in Mexico. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
From the Fronteras desk, a federal judge ruled late Tuesday that the Trump administration can't end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, commonly known as DACA, while a lawsuit decides the program's fate. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports on the uncertainty faced by roughly 700,000 so-called dreamers.
Carlos Yanez is a DACA recipient and a freshman at ASU. He was in the shower Tuesday night when his mom started yelling to him that a judge had reinstated the program that protects him from deportation. The news made him happy and excited, but...
Right now, I just really don't know what to feel. I'm going to wait it out and see what happens, but I don't want to get my hopes up.
Yanez's DACA permit expires in August, which is why he'd already set aside his dream to become a doctor. But the new court order says the government has to give DACA extensions to anyone who qualifies. Yanez now says he'll apply for a renewal and keep studying at ASU. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in science news, a group of Fountain Hills residents has been working to make sure the stars shine bright over their town. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Mariana Dale reports.
Fountain Hills is the latest Arizona community to receive a dark sky designation from an international organization. Oak Creek, Flagstaff, and Sedona have already been recognized for their efforts to prevent light pollution. Fountain Hills Dark Sky Association co-chair Joe Bill says his group sought the designation in response to an increase in outdoor LED lighting.
It would really create what is called a sky glow, which is a glow over urban areas that prevents you from seeing the stars.
Fountain Hills lighting law requires shielding of bright outdoor lights and warmer color temperatures below 3,000 Kelvin. The American Medical Association warns high-intensity LED light can disrupt human sleep and wildlife. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.